Just hit it. There we go.
Anyway, welcome everybody to the September edition of the CIO peer group. Very happy to have Akshay Kalle, CTO of Pathway Communications and the CTO of ElasticCare. Both are Markham-based technology firms doing completely different things, but making a difference within the country and around the world. And I want to thank everybody for the great conversation we've had this morning. And thank you to Lan and Radha and Ray for giving us some ideas for some further sessions. With that, I will hand it over to Ray Gilbert, who will be facilitating this peer group and actually will be the presenter. And with that, let it rip, guys.
Hey, well, good morning to everyone. Akshay, very much. Thank you for joining us this morning. I think one of the sessions, we all kind of know each other. I think we've met before at one of these sessions. So the focus this morning was to do the best we could to essentially have a interview kind of conversation. But since we all know each other, I've got, there's more than one moderator, Kelly. There's going to be a few of us. I will expect Lan and others to obviously speak up and bring their expertise to the conversation. So if I can set the stage for a minute, I'll do my best. We've all, the last conversation we had, we were probably immersed in 2 months of pandemic environment. We've just spent a few minutes and we'll warm up to this session talking about how much it's impacting all of our lives and the new world of being Zoom friends versus colleagues from with other connections. So I think what we wanted to do this morning was start out and say, you know, what we are in a new economy. There's a whole bunch of new pressures and impacts on individuals. And I wanted to turn to Akshay for a couple of reasons. One is that we know uniquely he's involved with launching a healthcare startup with a unique technology, trying to solve a very difficult technical problem, but of great value. At the same time, is leading technically an organization that really has, well, for the moment, I'll call a more traditional customer base, dealing with IT cloud issues and communication issues. So I think he has an opportunity to share with us some unique perspectives of, you know, what is in this new economy and what's the post-COVID world look like and how is he seeing those two spaces behave and react to it. So maybe that would be the first question I would like to invite him to share some comments with the team. Akshay?
Thanks, Ray. Thanks, Ryan. First of all, you know, thanks for having me, for hosting me. And again, thanks for everyone's patience. I appreciate everyone kind of waiting for me, you know, to run back after a school drop-offs for the kids. So, you know, this is our practical kind of COVID life that we've got, right? Everyone's got to be masked. And, you know, so when we talk about post-COVID, maybe this is, you know, either everyone's getting into sanitizers and masks. Maybe that's one way for everyone to diversify. I just want to take, you know, maybe 10, 15 seconds to just kind of intro, you know, I think Ray and Ryan probably give me a very gracious introduction. But my role, I think, as a CTO is really, you know, I'm trying to figure out just even for myself to what relevance really looks like. And I think in the long term, it's probably going to be less of a technical expert, but more of a, you know, kind of an arbitrage expert. And I'll talk about more about that towards the end. But relevance, I think, in post-COVID economies for every company is really going to have to be about diversity and about agility. And it's got to be less about the technical fascination that each one of us may have in a technical capacity if we're CIOs or CTOs. And a fair number of us are quite either out of fascination or insecurity or out of, you know, trying to just establish our relevance and prove it to the companies that we really are kind of the propeller heads in the room, tend to focus very heavily on that. But, you know, as you'll kind of see later on in the talk and the presentation, it's going to become less about that. And I feel really in the coming weeks, months, and years, not least because the entire business model of the value chain has really changed. I'm sure all of you are really familiar with what the value chain model and Porter analysis and all those scores look like. But if we look at the Porter scores of each of our industries over time, it's become really kind of a big polarized rip. And whatever we can do, as smart as you can be from a technical side, we're going to have to take a really humble look and step back and realize we're not going to be able to compete with the massive people out there. is that you're looking at companies that are trillionaires and 2 trillion companies, and that they can, with a head fake, just completely decimate or make an entire industry. They can move entire markets. So the eventuality looks to be, if you can establish a foothold somewhere on the path to an acquisition, then that's what it's got to be. It's got to be very cyclical at this point. And try and, rather than making iterative improvements, really try and make improvements that are quite massive in that sense. So when we talk about relevance, I would say try to be, ironically, as a CIO or a CTO, less technical but more business minded, and really look for things that are in these really quote unquote unsexy spaces in the analog world, because given the barriers to entry in the digital space are so low now, you're just competing against too many people. So that's really how I'd kind of characterize relevance in kind of the new post economy. And I'm not really diving in, if you notice, into anything technical, but I'll show you a little bit later on in kind of a summative series of slides why I say what I'm saying so far. But Ray and Ryan, I'll kind of turn it over to you to field any kind of quick questions about this area, or just off to the panel in general there.
Yeah, if I could take your comments, Akshay, and I'm going to turn to you, Lan. You have the unique aspect, and you shared just a little bit before we started of the seismic change the city faced. Do you have some things that you would observe that either in support of or would add to what Akshay said about the city? Because the city was in, I think, best way to put it, in shock and managing a crisis back in the spring. Now it's got to deal with a new status quo, which is what we're talking about. Are you seeing it, from the colleagues, from your contacts in the CIO Association, are you seeing a sea change in what their mindset is and their behavior is?
I think this whole, issue around supply chain, right? I would echo what he just said in terms of the barrier to entry to digital in terms of competition is really also creating quite a lot of challenge because from a procurement from the city procurement, that's already a challenge. But going back to the customer experience, right? how does the city really gonna compete with so many diverse startup and also community-based services to ensure that not only from a policy, but also from a customer experience, there will be, more integrated supply chain of services, right? Because the city cannot provide all the services. So you have to rely on agency, you have to rely on so many different kind of a managed service. How do you really ensure as a city or with so many existing services on-prem, front store that you have to deal with versus services that you are going to be relying into external service provider, right? And how do you manage and transition into the digital government, we call it digital government services, in a way that you can still maintaining the whole public safety, public privacy, and the interest of the public. And then on the top of that, how do you actually also come up with the, we call it this day user fee structure that will help you to maintain, transition from where we are into the digital world, and would never be a completely digital world, but it has to be a hybrid, right? So I'm going back to the very fundamental customer experience that not only seems to be also very, very challenging for the businesses, service businesses, but also equally from the government.
Yeah, thank you. Other comments about the introduction Akshay shared with us about what he's seeing in the new environment from some of our other attendees? Stephen or Sam, any thoughts you wanted to add to the comments that have been made?
No, Ray, I share the same feedbacks as Len, that the whole model is changing, apart from the things that Len said, we are also hearing that the entire office space economy of Manhattan Island is going to completely change in the post-COVID world. and leading to office spaces like remaining empty. There's so many different things that are being talked about. There's a lot of uncertainty around it, and that also adds to the opportunities that is being talked about in this, saying that it is going to become a whole lot of easier to launch businesses because you don't need a formal infrastructure. You can get started as long as you have a technology. It will be much easier for you to get to the market.
Okay, thank you. Other comments? I'd like to jump back to, if I could, to a word. Akshay, you mentioned the word relevance, and you kind of nicely said, at a personal level, you're feeling challenged to understand what the relevance of the announced or anointed technical leader is for an organization. As I mentioned earlier, you kind of see two worlds. You see the world where you have customers on the pathway communication side. Do you observe those customers in general, how do you see them responding to the current COVID challenges? And are they breaking into two groups? One group really kind of gets it. One group is working strictly from fear or survival. Do you see something in the kind of contacts you have on that side of your business world?
I'd be lying if I said, a great many of our customers, or even for us, we weren't challenged or we weren't puzzled and afraid in some senses. And it's okay to say that, because I think it's, if you walk into it with a cavalier attitude and saying, oh, this is all fine, it's all opportunity and goodness, then, it's a little bit of a, it can, once you believe you've arrived, I think that's kind of the beginning of the end, right? We do have to take attitude because there's too much that has changed. Mm-hmm. As regards to our clients, a lot of them are having to pivot. We definitely see some of our clients from the pathway side, definitely, they are in a spot of bother, and we, from our perspective, we're doing whatever we can to help them. I mean, it's not from a just really self-interested perspective, but because the economy itself is run by SMEs, SMBs, the majority of the cash is going to go around through there. And so while there's this great emphasis on, making sure the banks are doing okay and the big cap stocks are fine, especially in Canada, that's actually not where the lifeblood of the economy lies. It's really imperative that we support the small to mid-sized enterprises and really make sure that, you're looking out for your neighbor in that sense. Me in particular, there's a particular trap that we can fall into. Like I said, we often look to, and I'm going to address Lan's point here, is to government for leadership. And in our case, in healthcare, when we talk about relevance, what I'm seeing for the patient side is that they're willing to do whatever it takes in order to just get better, because this is no longer a small discretionary case where I've just got a scratch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is where if I don't get immediate care, I am literally going to asphyxiate to death or watch a loved one do the same. And I don't say this for effect, but this is actually how the rest of the world is dealing with this. Mm-hmm. We've launched part of our business from the ElastiCare side in India. And let me tell you, it's, there's parts of it that are, being very well handled. They don't really rely on government for support. A lot of things are privatized over there because government is just too big to be functional, quote unquote, right? And you've got 1.1 billion people. You can't possibly legislate your way towards agility that way. And in certain areas, it's a raging dumpster fire. So how do you kind of gather, the halfway point? The caution I would say is that governments really do need to be agile and aware of what's going on. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, people will start to look towards, people who are selling snake oil in the private sector. And there are a lot of people who have come out of the woodwork there. And whether it's from AI or ethics or whether it's for the healthcare side of it, the governments really do need to step up and be agile. And from the procurement side of it, the entire old adage of, well, no one got fired for hiring IBM, I'm telling you, there's a great many companies in Canada that are doing a good job, mm-hmm. but they have left and they are not interested in serving the Canadian market. Yeah. I can tell you wholeheartedly, this is just me saying this, this is not going to represent the views of Pathway or ElastiCare in that sense. Me as an individual, if I had to make a new startup tomorrow, I would not launch it in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would not try and sell into the government sector because I just don't have the government support. If anything, the client support is there, but there are just so many regulatory barriers. There are just so many, it's very parochial in that sense to be able to launch it. And it doesn't support that. So you can look at things like Shopify as being a great success, et cetera. our per capita expenditure, yes, is great, and our hit rates, but we really need to do a better job of supporting startups and the SMEs. You can't just rely on four or five businesses that are on the TSX to be able to say, well, this is, you know, we've arrived and Canada's done a great job. So even government, I think, really at the local level has to recalibrate. Someone's going to come up from a small business perspective to pitch something. Give them the time, listen to them, figure out how you can help them help you. That Jerry Maguire moment has to be there, I think, on both sides, right? And, you know, as Darth Vader says, you know, search your feelings, you know it to be true. So, I think there's a lot we can kind of talk about post this. I know, Ray, you've got quite the agenda. Should we kind of keep moving to the next one?
Yeah, no, I was gonna ask, because you've really, a good way to put this is, you know, what are the roles? Well, how to be relevant? There's always been this challenge when you're employed. Are you selling yourself to maintain your job, get your next job, and so on in your corporate environment? The role of the CXO community, you know, what thoughts do you have on what's changing for them? You know, are they all feeling the same relevant challenge with either a technical strength or a technical handicap? What's your view on the role for the next 3 years for the technical leader or CXO community?
Unless you're an authority on a technical topic, try not to be a technical leader. Try to be a collaborative leader that's going to be a facilitator and the glue between the different talent in an organization. It's a very familiar trap, again, that people fall into, is that they'll hire people who are in their image rather than hiring people who are smarter and more specialized than them. So the role of CXO, again, has to be about collaboration and a tremendous amount of humility that we classically have not had to bear before. Technical people, you know, we tend to stray into areas that are not our core expertise. You've got computer scientists talking about, you know, cognitive neuroscience and psychology, and it's a lot of, Dunning-Kruger these days, for anyone who knows what that effect is. But we, in some sense, we've got to stay in our lane, but you've got to allow experts to come in and let them do their best job. The CXO, the entire C-suite, really has to be more of a collaborative structure rather than a series of specialized islands. As an example, I mean, you look at China. China's produced more AI experts in 1 year than Canada probably has in the last 10. So if we're going to think that we're the AI experts, we are very far mistaken. We really need to look beyond our borders. Hire some of the people that are coming over, you know, from different countries, whether it's India, China, Philippines, Malaysia, East African countries. There's a lot of talent, but employ them, but give them the correct direction and let them do their job.
Akshay, is it a little late? I mean,
specialist.
I wonder if we could sort of maybe pick a model and ask for comments from you and the team. Is it a little bit more like being a professional sports team coach? You've got all these talented individuals for whom you're not going to teach them the game, but you do have to stitch them together into successfully winning in the marketplace. Is that a better way of finding relevance and value for a CX position role?
Yeah, and I think that's a great way to sum it up, Ray. It's, you've got to be a great coach and you've got to be a great team builder. And we have to look really globally. So when I talk about, for example, the entire value chain arbitrage equation, rather than trying to pick up a book on deep learning, go and pick up Drucker, right? Go and pick up something else that's going to, go pick up Scott Galloway's book, right? I know it's a kind of a plug for him, but I think he also does a tremendous job of explaining how these horsemen, so-called, of the, you know, the hyperscale economies are going to happen. So if you can somehow convert your supply and value chain into having really, really low marginal costs per unit, and if you can end up getting massive LTV out of, you know, and just manage to get your CAC paybacks very, very quickly, this is the type of parlance that the CXO needs to be able to seek fluidly across the entire C-suite. It can't be about, well, I've optimized, you know, gradient descent and I found a new a function. I'm using ReLU as opposed to using the, you know, the sigmoid function over that. Like, no one's going to care about that because someone else has already optimized it. Yeah. Right? There's some 17-year-old sitting in Lagos in Nigeria who's going to run circles around you.
Yeah.
That sense. Yeah. I'm not trying to joke about that, but I've literally
a
17-year-old who works out of an internet cafe in Nigeria, and he's doing an amazing work.
Yeah.
I don't say that for effect. This is the world in which we're living at this point.
Yeah. Akshay and others, please comment. Does that mean one of your challenges is, if you assume you're going to coach this extremely talented, internationally sourced team, is it finding those gems becomes a real core value that you can bring to the corporation?
Yeah, it's being able to spot and having just enough knowledge to be able to focus on results. I think one of the things that I also find when, you know, the specialized C roles kind of go in or they're building an organization is they're highly focused only on one or two functions. You have to have a little bit of a vocabulary of the different areas too, right? The CIO needs to speak a little bit of the finance side. The finance guy should, you know, or man or woman should also speak a little bit of the tech. And the CEO, well, she should also be speaking a little bit of the tech language. We can't just say, well, this is my job and, you know, my end of the boat isn't sinking, so to speak, right? Or my end of the boat is kind of, we're all in one boat. You have to be able to talk the different languages as such. But, you know, acquiring that talent, I don't think there's any shortage of talent in the world. It's just a matter of how do you figure out how to really optimize that P&L. It's more about P&L and structural operational optimization these days in an arbitrage fashion, rather than trying to be really inward looking and figuring out that, you know what, I should build everything before I buy it. You look at the large hyperscale companies, they only started building stuff on their own once they reached the first 200 million in revenue.
Okay.
Before that, it was all buy and then resale or wholesale. All they were was the glue between the different steps in the value chain.
Right. Okay. So that impacts a great deal what the role of that CX individual is, be the technology or even marketing oriented, that he's really doing, accepting that everything's already there and he's doing arbitrage to put the building blocks together.
And listen, that's not going to be a popular thing for me to say. It's not a popular thing to hear because everyone's going to want to say, look, we need to create more jobs. We want to create this. We want to hire more people. Well, if someone came up to you and said, look, I've got a wonderful piece of technology that could call 50,000 people a day and then check in on their health status, listen to what they're saying in 10 different languages and get back to you on there. A lot of people would say, and I know Lauren's smiling about this, she might say, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
But I think realistically speaking, Lauren, you would have a tremendously difficult time selling this because at some point people would say, well, what happens to, you know, Bob and Jane and Wendy and, you know, where do they go? What happens to their jobs? So these interests come on and we've got to figure out how to reallocate this labor. And it's actually a very good and important question. When we talk about automation, AI, the new products these days are all based on putting a lot of power into the hands of a very few companies. And we really have to wonder what the future of that will look like. So the role of the CXO, we really are going to come upon an existential, ethical, philosophical juncture where you're going to say, look, in order for me to have a really great looking P&L, does that mean I'm going to put 50,000 people out of work?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
Amazon has automated a whole bunch of their factories. Mm-hmm. If you look at the quality of the work within there, well, there's a debate about that. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying they happen to be, you know, soon they're going to be a $2 trillion company. I'm just saying, look at their P&L.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the way that he does pricing, Bezos, is all based, you know, arguably on a very predatory model. If you make more than 10% net operating profit on that, he will yell at his staff and say, why are you not putting it back and giving it back to the customer? So this is the type of mindset that I'm talking about. So when you talk about roles, I'm really taking a macro step back and saying, think about the economics of how the operating chain works rather than just saying, well, you know, this is a cool looking neural network.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned a couple of times, Akshay, during your discussion about, you know, the word product came up and what needs to happen in that world. I think the other thing you've mentioned is the leadership, for the moment, I'll drop technical, the leadership or anyone who perceives they're in the C-level, they need to innovate their personality and their approach to the marketplace. What's happening from your perspective in product design?
Product design is a constantly evolving field, and you know, even for me, I'm a student of it as much a practitioner of it, and I'm learning something new every day. And for me, some of the the best education has come from a very wide and diverse field. You know, I would humbly offer that don't just look only to the tech industry, but look outside as well. You'd find some tremendous innovation in sometimes the poorest areas of the world, where they're managed to be able to come up with some incredible ways and efficiencies of doing things without having a lot of technology. I'll use the example, for example, in India, there's this entire concept of these, you know, what they call, literally translates as box people, and they're lunch delivery people.
Yeah, we heard about that, yeah.
And this is a very, very famous case study, right? Where, and it goes back, I mean, decades, right? These people go back to the, you know, 30s and 40s, but they don't have any technology, but they manage to have better than Six Sigma quality control with a peer-to-peer delivery network for lunch that gets within, like I said, in excess of Six Sigma quality.
Yeah.
And so it's a wonderful, organic, you know, non-technical way, but the algorithm behind it is still kind of being studied, and they have, you know, shorthand notation, et cetera. So there's wonderful motivations and implementations that are out there beyond just our technical immediacy that we have that every one of us can benefit from. There are certainly a lot of frameworks. I think, you know, I would suggest the general C-suite go to a product innovation or a design thinking seminar, or at least try and practice some of these things internally, because it'll help them ideate and really come to grips with putting the customer first in a way that they didn't anticipate before. And that you'll find a lot of surprising outcomes.
Yeah.
In the entire concept of innovation. Innovation doesn't necessarily mean doing something de novo. It can mean just making a jump in terms of a KPI for something, but you really should identify what does success look like. Does it mean faster? Does it mean cheaper? Does it mean better? Well, let's break down better. What does that look like? Does it mean less clicks, et cetera? But iterative necessarily isn't, you know, the way to go. You've got to have a markedly big jump to do that. So, you know, that would probably be my overall thesis here in terms of product design and innovation, which is to have a diverse set of motivations and immersions that will educate you. And this should go up and down the entire, you know, kind of company ladder, or I should say left and right. I don't really believe in hierarchies and stratification as such, but everyone should be in some form of product education and product design education these days. I think it's more relevant now than it's ever been before.
Mm-hmm. The thing I'd like to ask the team, are we seeing in the post-pandemic world, innovation driven by managing a crisis is maybe where we're stuck, or are we seeing innovation windows, doors, opportunities open up that haven't been there before for organizations? Have we got some feelings or opinions? Akshay, please feel free to offer your thoughts, but Radha, Stephen, have you got some thoughts on what's happening around you that you can see? Are we changing what we do just because we're threatened? Are we changing what we do because, oh, I'm threatened, but in that process of solving the threat or facing it, I've realized that I can now innovate in a certain way. What are we seeing examples of both types? Comments?
Ray, yes, I think it was happening for some time, but in this COVID world, it is completely changing the role of CIO. It doesn't stop at technology. What we are seeing is that the company, the college, or the organization is looking forward to leadership on all fronts from the CIO. That's the kind of a thing that we are seeing. There is no boundary. It's not restricted to technology. It goes into business processes. It goes into strategies and all those things. In my case, more specifically, compared to many of the organizations, as a CIO, I report to the president directly. So I'm there at the senior executive table. The kind of discussion that happens, and they all look forward to the CIO to provide input to things that are nowhere related to technology. And this change is happening and accelerating during the COVID world.
Radha, could I ask a question along with that? Has there been, let's get some insight, has there been a change on the conversation you're having with the CEO? In other words, I'll just go back to a classic one. You can say that never happened, but in my experience, often historically, the business leaders talked to IT when they had to, not because it was something they needed to feel they were in touch with on a routine basis, They just came when they really wanted it. Problem solved. Is it today that it's like you pick the phone up and the first thing you do is have a chat with your CEO because he wants to know. There's lots of conversation. There's lots of touch points that need to go because it's such a dynamic environment. Has it changed like that, or is it changing like that?
Yes, it has changed. But I would like to add that it has changed because we were already moving in the direction of helping the college beyond just the technology. Like, for example, we had put in a digital strategy in place, and we were in the process of executing it for nearly 2 years. And when this COVID-19 pandemic hit, in comparison to the other 23 colleges, Seneca College was in a much better place to adopt and move forward into the online model. Having seen that, we are seeing in the past 6 months, the conversation has changed. The trust and the capability of ITS as an organization to deliver beyond the technology value is being seen and appreciated. That is helping to more calls coming from the CEO and president and the senior executives to say that, what can I do in this? They are seeking out and asking for advices. That hasn't happened in the past.
Okay, thank you. Sam or Stephen, you've heard our conversation. Are you seeing similar things in your spaces or other comments you'd like to offer?
Well, I'm going to put my feedback on this. We are in the innovation space to start with, so we're always innovating. Saying that, the COVID environment definitely made an impact on the way we look at stuff and which items do we address now versus what we were having plans. Definitely that change has put a lot of pressure on our ability to deliver solutions that are not only innovative but practical for the current environment. And actually put pressure from organizational piece from our side, the way we conduct business, because all our team is now remote. So, and all our work with our client is 100% remote. You know, we were like maybe 90% remote, but now we're 100% remote. So it put a lot of pressure on us to even push that boundary of innovation and product development more specifically to answer the demand in the market. Only around, I would say, communication tools within our applications. So that was the biggest impact from our side.
Thank you. Stephen, anything you'd like to add? Not? Okay. All right, thank you. Akshay, I think one of the other things, again, you were kind enough to help support us today. And last year, we had a great conversation about AI and where it was. And offering, quite frankly, at that session, you offered the opportunity for people to please understand what this technology is, but many of the implications that represented it. But it hasn't gone away, and you kind of mentioned that it's not the algorithm you're playing with. It's not the, you know, you can get experts to give you algorithms that are almost unlimited. It's marrying that to the business. What's the view now? What are you seeing? Because it's core to your Elastic Care world to have an AI solution, because it's not just the hardware. Thoughts, feedback on, you know, where we are in AI and what's happening in the automation space?
Look, I'm one of those people who's going to look at AI and automation as just, you know, a very high, you know, very related concept, super way of data obedience more than anything. All right, we'd like to just call it AE rather than AI. And that being said, I mean, there is a lot to be learned, I think, by a lot of the C-suite to understand what the capabilities and the limitations are in terms of outputs. When we try and automate something and we're trying to automate, say, understanding of a given data set, we're just throwing thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of data points at something and trying to find a pattern. Well, is it trying to find, you know, what we call in statistics, the mode or the median? Or is it trying to find the outlier? Trying to find out causal relationships is also very important, but that's not something people really look into. So for all practical intents and purposes, this is just expediting things that would ordinarily be done by human beings, but there's certainly an increasing gap in terms of understanding and in terms of the ethics of how we just, you know, so-called abdicate our accountability. And there's no less than, I think, something like 134 different AI ethics frameworks and counting right now today. And a lot of them talk in a lot of generalities. But, and I think that that's exactly demonstrating that the point is that there doesn't seem to be a singular consensus. There's a lot of kind of these motherhood statements about, okay, well, let's make it accountable and transparent and clear. But there's cutting edge research going on about how do you explain what a neural network is doing? It's just what a series of nonlinear weighted sums of inputs that, you know, reduce the dissonance between the inputs and the outputs and then end up giving you a kind of an equation. That's effectively what a neural net does. Now, how do you unwrap that in a way that our roughly two-dimensional minds can understand when you're dealing with, you know, classically hundreds or thousands or millions of dimensions? And so this is, as human beings, I mean, we also need to take a humble view to realize that technology and this progress, it seems to be under no obligation to make itself simple for us, is that we may ourselves have our own cognitive limits. But if that's truly the case, we really need to take a step back and say, all right, we should have a way of having a safe and accountable way in order to progress steadily rather than just progressing headlong into something and you know, kind of the results be damned. And there's a big moral hazard concerning that. And nowhere have we seen that more these days when nation states start using AI at really at an industrial level where it's to monitor their own people. Everyone's seen probably, you know, the Steven Spielberg movie, you know, from many years ago where they talk about the precogs, right? You can try and figure out if someone is going to commit a crime and you preemptively arrest them. So while we may, you know, we kind of wrote that off as a fancy about 15 years ago, well, today it's actually the reality in many countries. Mm-hmm. And we should realize that. And so we should also realize in Canada, we're quite fortunate that we haven't instituted such things yet. Or that maybe it's against our charter, right? And that we believe in a certain process. And so in that sense, we should be quite thankful that we don't live in a society that applies AI and automation in that sense in the name of safety and betterment. So we've seen a lot of that, especially in COVID. People have started using a lot of automation to, you know, apply it to various contexts. While you can talk about it from an innovative perspective, the other thing I'll also say is, apart from don't drink the Kool-Aid, let's realize that we, 99% of businesses and in excess of that, are not in a position to reasonably apply, you know, these highly sophisticated algorithms. You don't run companies, even we don't run a company, to be totally honest with you, that has hundreds of millions of users and trillions of data points. Sure, I mean, as a service provider, we have a lot of data. But guess what? We have made the decision to not analyze our users' data and to not use it in a way that will be monetizable. We have made that conscious decision. It's sure, it's held us back in a lot of ways, but we also believe in a certain ethos in terms of operating. Now, I'm not dictating that to everyone else to say, you know, this is how your business ethics compass should be calibrated, but it just takes, you know, it's going to give everyone kind of a moment of pause to think about how they want to calibrate their business. But by and large, if you're manufacturing nachos or you're making shoes or you're making some type of a vaccine, okay, well, yeah, I may help you with your factory to try and make it a little bit more efficient, but it's not going to turn you from $100 million company into a $1 trillion company overnight. It may help you reduce your inefficiencies, and that's where probably you should be looking at in terms of the value chain, the so-called the underpinning services.
Akshay, I think one thing you're saying is it's not a silver bullet that's just going to magically make things work better for you. It really is a focused application and finding the business results. What are the kinds of things that you feel, you know, we as an audience or we as professionals should think about to try and get value out of that automation / AI world over the next, I don't know, 3 months, 6 months? What's been hype and needs to be essentially downplayed and realized that's what it is? What are the things you can actually work with and take some value from? You got some thoughts there?
Yeah, the advice I would give is, first of all, go and take an online course in how the stuff works, but don't try and become an expert and take a, you know, what they call a survey course to figure out how these things work. And try to understand intimately the distinction between finding the common pattern, the thing that's most common, versus finding what the outlier is. And realizing the distinction between a cause and an effect. And let me illustrate why that type of learning is very important. If you are making some type of a system that is going to hire people, just as an example, and your training data is purely based on those people who were hired successfully into your firm, you're going to end up with a lot of what they call survivor bias. You may not understand that you are leaving out a lot of people or being unduly biased against the people who didn't make it in. You've also got a lot of selection bias. So if you don't understand what these concepts are, you're going to not only just do yourself a disservice, you're also going to do a disservice to society at large. And many of those things are of concern to you. So I would say take a survey course and understanding the nature of algorithms and how they work in general. Don't need to go down and start coding, but just understand what and how they function. I would also say, look at issues around your own supply chain and your own operating chain. Go and talk to your COO, go down to the factory floor, go down and talk to the people who are really doing the actual delivery side and figure out, is there something that I can do to just grease the wheels? Can I take, you know, can I reduce my per unit cost? Is there something that I can turn from a per head? Can I turn that from a variable into a fixed cost, or just reduce that cost by an order of magnitude? And those are areas where you'll figure out the tool for the job and hire an expert to do that. But your job really as the CXO is going to be able to say, here's how my company runs. And here's my costs for each operation and each step that I take in my delivery chain. Then bring in an expert to figure out how can I automate or how can I make that a little bit more expedient.
Thank you. If I wonder if I could turn to our my colleagues a little bit. And if you don't mind, Rod, I'd like to, can I select you again? Only because I perceive that you're surrounded by a fairly robust supply chain, suppliers, sellers, of solutions that you might have. And just on the hype side, I would presume every one of them has AI somehow stapled to the title of their product. To be honest, how do you look through what's veneer and has substance? It's trying to find that on the, if I take Akshay's example, going to the shop floor and finding that one or two items that really moves things forward. Have you had some success, maybe some problems in that space? What do you do to look through the fog?
I have three comments, right? Like one is that going back to the initial discussion, yes, at Seneca, we also feel that using AI would certainly improve our operational efficiency, but we don't see it beyond it to be used as a silver bullet or anything. And we have a chatbot. We were one of the first colleges to get into a chatbot, and we're seeing that it helped quite a bit for us to manage, especially the students who are outside of Canada who are working in different time zones and all. It was able to really take on a lot of workload that we couldn't have managed anyway. These are the kind of operational efficiencies that we are seeing. Second, the discussion that happened regarding the privacy in some countries that have been using AI for different purposes. I actually witnessed it 2 years ago when I went to Shenzhen, where the entire city has got cameras everywhere that tracks every citizen, every movement of them, at every traffic signal, at every corner, it is there. And when I went to the company's headquarters, Huawei showed me that it can take a picture of my face and it can tell you in the past 12 months, what have been my movements.
Scary.
It was unbelievable. It was scary. Like when they tried to show it to our president, he said that don't even bring it near me. We cannot even think of these kind of things. And all. So like it's scary. Like it's very scary that here in Canada, we've got such stringent privacy restriction that you cannot even think of doing it. Whereas there's another country that which has been implementing so freely. That's the kind of a risk that is there. And to your last question, Ray, how we've been using AI in our space, we don't run an assembly where it helps to find the odd things on the floor space, but we've been using AI for the student success, where we are implementing a software which belongs to the space of predictive analytics and AI, those kind of things. What it does is that it looks at the students in their first few weeks of starting a term and then starts to predict. These are the students who are at risk. Go and make an early intervention to them and then work with them, provide them the guidance, mentoring, learning, etc. Otherwise, they wouldn't make it till the end of the term. Mm-hmm. We didn't have these kind of tool sets before AI came into play. And we've rolled it out in a pilot now, but we are slowly expanding it because it's a change. People need to adapt to that change. We just don't want to do a full rollout. At the end of it, people are not able to understand it. The whole thing falls flat. So we're taking baby steps to make sure that people are comfortable in saying that out of the 40 students in a class, why are we picking these three students? It should not have a racial bias. It should not have any kind of things and all. It should be based on scientific facts. So we've been very careful in implementing, but that's one area where we are seeing a benefit from AI.
Yeah, sure. If I may, I think we've seen many of the aspects of what Akshay mentioned in the two stories you were able to share with us, which is terrific. I'd like to turn to all the other attendees. Other comments we'd like to make? We're sort of getting towards the end of our time period. I think we'll pass it back to Ryan in a moment.
Yeah,
but I'd like to ask if there's any other wrap-up comments from the audience. And
actually,
go ahead, Ryan.
Sorry, I do have a question about manufacturing, actually. I know this story gets old. So I have another job. I work at a bike shop on weekends. And, you know, there's a massive bike shortage, and there's going to be a massive bike shortage and part shortage for about 2 years. And most of the manufacturing happens in Asia. Will we see a trend where automation and robots are going to be more present in manufacturing? Because it can't only just be bikes that are having an issue. Even just seeing the car lots here in my town, like here in Uxbridge, there's no inventory anywhere. And I know there's shortage on a whole bunch of stuff like across the world. Will we see robots really starting to replace the human worker? Or is that going to be, you know, we see this like in Star Trek and Star Wars. Nobody ever seems to work. It's all manufactured by robots and everybody's living a perfect life. Will we start seeing more of this if we continue seeing more COVIDs and other natural disasters and other things happening in the world to replace the human? So manufacturing never does stop, because obviously there's a shortage of a bunch of stuff across the world.
I think your question's pretty kind of micro and a little bit more macroeconomical in nature. I mean, what's going to happen longer term with automation in general? My view on automation has been as follows. It's not going to be the blue collar worker that's going to be as affected at least immediately. It's really the white collar worker that'll be affected first. So the people who are going to be designing these things, the people who are the management consultants, the risk analysts, the accountants, et cetera, they're actually going to be more at threat. Why? Because robo-advisors and financial consultants have already been automated. Yesterday, a family friend of ours, he just announced that they had exited, you know, their financial advisory firm. It was a robocall firm. It's like a robo-advisory firm, right? And how many people did they put out a job first? But you don't see plumbers going out of work right away. So, you know, to answer your question about manufacturing, I don't think that's going to be automated as immediately as some of the white collar jobs, right? And some of the higher up. So really they need to be more scared in terms of, you know, being existentially. And what that'll result in terms of your products is that they'll look a lot more homogenous, right? It's going to be like Demolition Man, right? You're going to end up having only, every restaurant is Taco Bell and the only store is going to be Amazon. You're going to have very limited choice, right? There's no more Energizer. There's just Amazon Basics. That's what you're going to end up getting. There's no diapers.com. It's just Amazon diapers. And again, not to be facetious about this, where you go on Amazon, you know that that's exactly it. You ask Alexa for batteries, she's going to recommend to you, just get the Amazon Basics, not the Energizer. You're not going to know what Energizer looks like. That being said, the production is also going to get highly consolidated. Right now, in terms of education, how many people here recommend their children to go into the trades?
I do.
You're probably in a very tiny minority. Everyone, you know, that I speak to, majority of people, and not all of them, say, look, doctor, lawyer, engineer, something. Well, guess what? There's going to be robotic lawyers, and there already are. I'm advising a startup that does that. And Ryan, you and I talked about this on, you know, during our podcast.
Yeah.
So manufacturing is still going to be consolidated. So when we talk about this disconnect and the so-called divorce between the US and China and everything, I don't see that practically happening because, first of all, China has a very, very large talent pool. They can fill entire football stadiums of engineers who can build you a fully automated factory, and also their cost of labor is extremely cheap for multiple reasons. Not least because how they might value certain aspects of delivery. But in North America, you just don't have the people, and the education system is not focused towards that. So it's not practical for us to try and divorce ourselves. What I do anticipate is that the prices for things are going to go up in the long term. If you want to get that manufactured in North America, you look at, for example, rare earths or even mining. There are mines in the rest of the world, Australia, US, et cetera. But in order to just build the automated or even manual facilities for that, we're a good 20, 30 years behind, right? Just in terms of education, building the infrastructure to get there. So yes, I mean, if you can make friends with a factory in China, if you really want to start up your own bike store, Ryan, I mean, you might be able to sell, Cervelo S3 that ended up costing, $2,500. You might be able to get it out for $9,000 now at this point, just because you've got some tie up with a company out in China, right? You can end up making your own carbon fiber or aluminum bike.
I would never sell Cervelo, no offense. We're seeing prices go up, like prices for bikes for next year are already up 10 to 15%. And it's a limited quantity run for the next 2 years because of mining. 6 months of no mining has led to a 2 to 3 year product gap. Yeah. It's very interesting to see where a lot of the stuff, sporting equipment and all that stuff, is going to go in the near future.
We seem to think of China as, these little 3, 4, 5 year old children hunched over a bench, mining borite with their hands and building circuit boards. But that's actually not the case. And I'm not trying to be an apologist for how many different aspects of the country run, but we have to realize that they've emphasized their educational system is much more focused on rote ways of learning that have created this industrial juggernaut, where they actually have a tremendously sophisticated automated delivery and manufacturing system that we as North Americans are frankly 20 years behind. And so for us to be able to play catch up in that sense is going to economically disadvantage us. If you tried to build the iPhone or your bikes here in North America, it would cost you probably $7,000-$8,000. Not because that's the labor aspect of it, just simply because the cost of building everything along the way, you have to pay that back, right? I mean, who's going to pay for it when the music stops?
Okay, thank you. Other comments from those online? I think, Akshay, we've been able to get through the themes that we hoped we could touch on today, but I'd like to offer, and first of all, thank you for what you've provided and your leadership both last year and this year and ongoing with Tech Connects. But I'd like to ask you if there's something you'd like to wrap up, comments you'd like to make, and then I'd like to turn it back to Kelly and Ryan to talk about next sessions and future CIO peer forums. But Akshay, do you want to take the lead in wrapping up our session this morning?
Yeah, if it's okay with you, I thought I'd maybe blow through a bunch of slides that I think might articulate what the general theme has been about. So just bear with me. I'm going to go through them super fast. So we talked, tie it all together here. We talked about products. So what do products as an intersection mean? I look at it like this. And this is what I've been taught, and this is what the outcome seems to be. And because it's inevitable, it's better for you to try and disrupt yourself before someone else does it. It's better for you to try and disrupt your own business model before someone else does it. And the reason why these two words are highlighted is because this is really going to depend on you, where your moral, your business ethical compass is going to be. There are a lot of businesses that do it a different ways. There's no right or wrong. It's just what price are you willing to pay for your P&L? When we talk about relevance and profitability, ultimately, it's going to come down to your P&L. You need to decide, are you trying to be fascinated or are you trying to be profitable? When we talked about things like design thinking, there's a whole bunch of, misinterpretations and misconceptions about what that concept entails. But here's kind of a rough breakdown versus chart. And Ray and Ryan, what I'll do is, I think at the end of the presentation, I'll send you a copy of the deck so that you can kind of distribute the contents as you need to, because I mean I've given this talk before in kind of a more detailed way, and I know generally these latter slides tend to be kind of the things that are most requested. But here I would probably point out the thing about design thinking here is the key thing is it's about numbers and ethnography. It's not really about the cutting edge. It's not about finality and it's not about profit at any cost, but it's really about understanding and being embedded with your audience and doing things that are going to be sometimes against what your natural instinct is, because it's not really about you. It's about what you're trying to serve. It's a very unselfish process. So here's a bunch of, you know, my selection of kind of bad choices that are being made both in the COVID and, you know, pre and post COVID era. Mm-hmm. Don't try and science your way out of a bad business model. I think, you know, when we talk about AI and machine learning, that's probably the most common trope that I see, is that saying, oh, I've got something cool, but there's just no business model that exists. I know Rakesh is on the line, but I'm going to put him on.
Are there other tenants in this space?
But I really admire his company because they've taken a really rock solid business model, and it hasn't been about the tech, but they've made their customers really happy by focusing on a solid business model. And I'd encourage you to look at Markham based and kind of Canadian companies like that really focused on a good business model with a true focus on empathy rather than just going, trying to hand wave away the business model. So you've got great leaders and examples within the community itself. Finally, when we talk about the process intersection over here, you look at what's feasible, viable, and desirable. So the intersection in there is what you want to focus on in terms of your product. I should say there's a little bit of a caveat here, all right, in that when we talk about what's feasible, the big giants don't really care about what's feasible because they've got, more money than Davy Crockett, right? They can basically just look at what's viable and desirable. But we, as kind of the mortals here, often have to focus on what we can pay for. They don't need to really worry about that. That being said, focus on things that are too small for them to do, which is a very ironic statement. Sometimes focus on the small and the analog, because that's going to be off the radar. It's not the cost of getting in there is not desirable for them. And one day they'll come and buy you out. Finally, just want to run some quick stats by you. Why is this important? Because these are some of the big companies that are out there that are socially influential. So when we talk about your acquisition funnel, if you're trying to look at data to drive in business over here, what makes these companies common? The fact that they're global, that's the fact that they have a very low customer cost of acquisition, and that their revenue per employee tends to be much, much more massive, right? And so this is typically the channels that they acquire their awareness from. So when we talk about these top two over here, you tend to go to them directly to search for stuff. You're not really going into the store and inspecting things. You're not really. So if you're looking at figuring out how to get your brand awareness in there for whatever you're selling, consider socializing with them, because it's no longer really about brand value. It's really about value monogamy. And that monogamy is, for example, the switching cost of considering something new is too high. Unless you've got a really big value prop for them to switch, they're not going to go for you at the end of the day. Finally, when we talk about a funnel, it's no longer a funnel, it's a keg. And these two places are where you're going to get your awareness. And this is where you'll end up buying from. In fact, now Amazon has exceeded in many ways what Facebook does in terms of awareness and advertising spend. And in 5 years, they're going to end up becoming the biggest single source of advertising revenue. Most likely, they're going to end up overtaking Google. Okay, Walmart, by the way, just quick head fake, stats. Amazon tends to add the market cap of Walmart to its to itself probably on the order of every 18 months. That should give you an order of where they're going and probably who you want to be bedfellows with. And these are the types of other sites that are probably specialized, at least for us, that we try and get some awareness on. But ultimately, we want to be on the top of the awareness funnel over there. So this also, by the way, happens to be your distribution and access area. Going back to, I think, the final point that we talked about, return on human capital. If you look at the return on human capital from Amazon over here, it's probably, $1.2 million per, employee that they'll end up having versus what you've got from Walmart, okay? Which is probably, a few thousand dollars or a few hundred thousand dollars. So if you've got a 10x improvement in terms of your ability to deliver, this is where we talked about marginal cost and cost per FTE. And cost per delivery for things. And this is going into the economics of things. That's why this entire conversation about the CIO really needs to be kind of tied together with the economics. It's not so much about what you can innovate. It's about who you can end up leveraging. So you can also leverage Amazon. You can leverage Walmart. You can leverage the rest of the Shopify's of the world to be able to push your product out. Okay, so I would encourage, like I said, pick up more of a book on business rather than trying to pick up a book on neural nets the next time. Finally, value chain model for AI. This is kind of the virtue cycle over here, but again, it's been exploited in mass by these companies. There's a reason that they're able to do that because they fall into the cycle. If you've got really flexible products, well, it's gonna come from your ability to tune. So see how you can end up joining this carousel, so to speak, because if you don't have the ability to be flexible, and if you're trying to do everything on your own as a CIO or a CTO, you're probably going to limit yourself from being agile. And this comment also applies to the government. If you try and build everything on your own rather than leveraging companies that can be more agile than the government, we will fall behind. The citizenry will not be served. In fact, they will go to private organizations in a shadow way that will not be approved by the government, just as they've done in India. The India, for example, a lot of people in India, for example, do not care about the FDA. Because if your child is starving or if they've got a fever of 103, you're not going to wait.
Yeah.
Maybe I wouldn't either. We are at that tipping point today in terms of innovation. And this is where I'd say, okay, government at every level really needs to step back and say, are you trying to say that, you know, we need to be, is it regulation that needs to be the priority, or is it big government that needs to be the priority, or is it we're trying to establish empathy and relevance with our citizenry? That's really where, you know, we talk about innovation, we got to have that ounce of humility kind of step in over there. Anyway, that's my kind of, you know, 5-minute soliloquy on the states of affair. Happy to take any questions, but in the meantime, I'll turn it back to Ray and Ryan. And again, thank you for having me. I appreciate your time, and it's been my privilege.
Ray, you're on.
Yeah, no, just, that's fine. I was just saying, Akshay, I think that was a great wrap up to the themes we've been through today. So, and again, we very much appreciate your leadership and your input to the team. Comments are brought, Ryan or Kelly, I'll turn it back to you, but thank you to everybody for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you, Akshay. Always a pleasure to hear from you. And thank you, Ray, for facilitation. For next month, I guess the team will put our heads together and come up with a couple of action items for the next session. I guess a couple of other things. We're looking to get Serena Chan. She's likely going to come talk to us in the new year. Kelly and I had we were very fortunate to meet a guy named Mark Dillon. He's interested in speaking as well. I think he's this former CIO for Kitchener-Waterloo or Sarnia.
Sarnia.
And he's got, he works at a securities company now. Really smart guy, really great speaker. And we're actually he's going to be doing something with us in October, I believe. So
it's October 14th.
Thanks. So yeah, with that, you know, have a great weekend. Kelly, what events do we have coming up for next week?
Next Wednesday is a fellow from Carpedia. He is the vice president there at Carpedia International, and he's actually going to be talking about performance and cultural alignment and how to align your teams to increase the predictability and profitability of your business. And he kind of does it using stories and making sure that you take away a few points. So that's at 12 o'clock. That would be a really good a good one. I've actually had a couple of people reach out and say, how did you get him? He's really good. So, you know, fingers crossed from that perspective. And as Ryan said, the fellow Mark Dillon, he's talking, and it's same thing, it's going to be a lunchtime session. And it's really about kind of how, and we touched upon this, and I think Radha talked about it a little bit, is that, you know, everybody was working in their office and then they ended up rushing to be at home. And how has that impacted the security within your own organization? So he's going to give three different stories on how you can actually measure security and learn how to manage it. And he speaks at a, you know, a relatively easy level there for most people to understand. So we will be in touch shortly regarding the next CIO session, and we wish everybody a fantastic day.
And one last thing is our AGM is coming up in October 21st. Yeah. Those who are primary contacts within the association will be receiving proxy forms. So please make sure you fill out your proxies, and the session will be done online. It'll be just a 1-hour AGM. Virtual session, so you know, be aware of those emails coming from TechConnects. And with that, thank you once again, everybody, for attending. Akshay, thank you again. This recording will be going up sometime today with the other peer groups from the week. So the recordings will be live on the website. And with that, we'll see you all shortly. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good weekend, everyone.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.